We are just 1 week out from the premier event focused on accelerating, automating, and scaling machine learning and AI in the enterprise. That's right, TwiMLCon AI Platforms. Over the past few weeks, we've shared a ton of details about the conference, including our live keynote interviews where I'll be on stage with Andrew Ng and leaders from Uber, LinkedIn, and Cruise. Our supersized two-track agenda, complete with speakers from Levi Strauss, Zappos, Capital One, Airbnb, and many more. Our community experiences, like our Day 2 Unconference, where attendees will propose and vote on topics to further explore in small group sessions. And the TwiMLCon Happy Hour, complete with food and drinks, interview and photo booths, an AWS Deep Racer contest, and much more. It's not too late to get your tickets, but you'll need to act fast if you don't want to miss out. Head over to TwiMLCon.com now and secure your ticket for what's shaping up to be an amazing event. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone, I am on the line with Kareem Bagheer. Kareem is the co-founder and CEO of InstaDeep. Kareem, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Hi, Sam. Thank you for having me.
You are very welcome to be on the show, and I'm looking forward to diving into the conversation. But before we get into our main topic, which will be focused on AI innovation in the field of logistics, I'd love to learn more about your background. You are in a, can we call it a unique position of having co-founded a deep learning company in Tunisia, North Africa. How did you get to that point?
Yeah, actually, I grew up in southern Tunisia, in a city which is very familiar to Star Wars lovers because it's actually Tatooine. So it's the same name that George Lucas used for the first, movie about Star Wars. So grew up in southern Tunisia, and my love of applied mathematics took me then to, you know, graduate education in France's Ecole Polytechnique, and ultimately to the U.S. at Courant Institute at NYU in the U.S. And InstaDeep is a project that, you know, I co-founded with with Zora that I met in Tunis, with the goal of, you know, basically proving that we can do, you know, advanced AI and deep learning in Africa. And it's been a crazy adventure for us. We started really with like two laptops and no funding. It was a pure bootstrap, and we're very excited to, you know, how much we've come since then.
Awesome. And the company to this day has most of its employees in Africa, all in Tunisia, or are there other locations?
So yes, majority of our employees are in Africa, something like 70% of the company. And after the original Tunis office, we also have opened up setup shop in Lagos in Nigeria, as well as Nairobi in Kenya, and looking forward to opening an office soon in South Africa. So it's been a very, very interesting ride in terms of like discovering the potential of African talent. And we also have two offices in London and Paris as well.
Okay. And so what's the company's focus?
So the company is focused on basically building advanced decision-making systems for the enterprise. So if you look at, you know, deep learning and uses of AI historically, most companies and most startups focus on pattern detection, so advanced uses of either machine learning or deep learning. But at InstaDeep, we actually believe that, you know, technologies around reinforcement learning and the like are coming now to a state of fruition that make them actually deployable for the enterprise, and we anticipate significant savings. So we are focusing on helping large companies realize the promise of AI, which is, of course, easier said than done. So our role is to help them, seize the opportunity in AI, while at the same time, you know, as discussed, building up a new generation of talent and making people believe that, you know, actually their dreams can come true, they can be part of this.
Nice, nice. You mentioned reinforcement learning. Yeah, that comes up on the show quite a bit, and there are very. It can be a polarizing topic in the sense that there are folks that I talk to that are very excited about it and the promise that it offers, not just in these traditional
RL applications like game playing, but for enterprise applications. And then there are other folks that say it's way too complicated. We're nowhere near being able to put it to good use. It sounds like you're in this latter camp.
So, yeah, we believe actually that the technology is sufficiently mature now to get to practical applications. I mean, if you see historically, you know, DeepMind started to become like DeepRL started to become something impressive with originally DeepMind and the progress they did with DQN on Atari games and the like. But now with, you know, progress on multiple fronts, it's actually possible to deploy these technologies in real life. And, you know, we expect this to become more and more mainstream. So we're actually doing work in multiple sectors, but in particular in logistics, that confirms that these technologies can actually be deployed and can actually generate savings versus more classical technologies.
Okay, and so we've referenced a couple of times the field of logistics, the connection being a presentation that you delivered at the recent NVIDIA GTC conference on some of the work that you've seen and that you're doing on AI and logistics. Can you maybe frame up the problem for us? What are some of the specific challenges that enterprises are seeing in logistics, and what are the gaps between, you know, logistics obviously has been a problem for many, many, many hundreds of years, and we've developed technology-based solutions to try to solve these problems. What are the gaps that are leading folks to look at deep learning and machine learning-based approaches?
So, you know, in logistics, you have multiple problems that actually require making decisions in a complex environment where you have a very large number of choices. So just a specific example, if you look at ride sharing, for example, for a mobility company such as Uber or others, effectively, you have a situation where you have hundreds of cabs in a big city, and at the same time, maybe, you know, hundreds or thousands of riders requesting a ride. And with ride sharing allowed, basically you can onboard, like, say, 3 to 4 people in a given cab. This is a complex decision to make. Which cab should cater to which requests? It's not an easy decision. And this is typical of what we believe is the opportunity for, you know, deep reinforcement learning based systems. So you effectively have to look for a needle in a haystack. And, you know, one of the ways to do that is actually to train a modern AI system to look for good solutions. So it really comes down to you have a very large search space, sometimes bigger than the number of atoms in the universe, and you need to find a clever way to go through this search space. So I'll tell you historically what enterprises have been doing to solve this problem is, you know, if you look at operations research, OR, typically, all the algorithms that are used in OR are clever ways to make that search space simpler, and they're more amenable to, you know, algorithms. So that is, you know, that works pretty well in practice, but it's far from being optimal. And typically, we're talking about problems that, you know, have a very large search space and can be NP hard, so it means that there is not an easy solution to solve them. So by making the search space smaller, you know, OR algorithms effectively are introducing biases. So, you know, they're built on heuristics, and those heuristics mean that a system that could learn from scratch could go beyond what is the state of the art at the moment. So it's very similar to what happened in the game of chess before AlphaZero came. So AlphaZero, the groundbreaking algorithm that DeepMind developed in late 2017, basically before AlphaZero, the best chess player was a system that had to, to use lots of rules, whether coming from the programming side of things or coming from the chess side of things. But like, there were hundreds of rules that were pretty much embedded into the program to make it do, you know, to make it competitive. Yet AlphaZero came and replaced all of that with just two simple concepts, searching and learning, and it was able to outperform, you know, Stockfish, this this particular chess program, in, you know, as little as 4 hours if you use distributed machine learning. So I was watching that. I was actually at NeurIPS for the first time when David Silver presented these groundbreaking results. And I was like, wow, this is actually very exciting. And it has applications that are beyond games. Like, think about, you know, as I said, the ride-sharing example I gave you, or, for example, you know, how you fit objects or packages in containers. All of those have this property that, you know, you need to look for the right solution in a very large amount of, a very large space. And so all of those are potentially amenable to this kind of solutions. And, you know, since then, we've been working very hard at InstaDeep to make this promise a reality for our customers.
When you're approaching a problem like the ride-sharing problem, how do you transform, you know, this problem that, you know, kind of makes sense when you explain it into something that you can apply directly deep learning or RL to?
So effectively, you need to build up a model of the environment first, which comes from, you know, the real world. So, for example, what we use at InstaDeep is OpenStreetMap. So we take actually the exact, information on traffic, on the topology of the city from OpenStreetMap, and we transform the problem of going from point A to point B and selecting different passengers into a set of possible actions and build it into an RL framework. That's exactly the same method that we would use, for example, on a problem like bin packing. You have a certain volume, you have certain constraints that you need to respect, and your goal is to find optimal configurations such that, the total volume that you're using is the smallest possible while respecting all the other constraints. So there is a significant work which is done on the environment, but the general principle remains the same. At the end of the day, you have, a reward function that comes out of this. Usually on NP-hard problems in logistics, it's very easy to verify if a given solution is a good one or not. What is not so easy is to find what is a good solution. So the problem of like scoring the result is usually not extremely difficult. You just need to build up the environment to make this possible, and then find ways to train this at scale.
So sticking with this ride-sharing example, is the assumption that for a given ride, you kind of start with a starting place and a destination may be determined by an initial rider, and you're trying to figure out what other riders to pick up?
Yes, basically you have to make decisions about which riders to take into the car, and the car could have two states. Like, it could either have already people in the car and given destination where to go, or it could be completely empty. So you have to make a decision about who do you want to onboard, and obviously if you onboard a given person, a given client, then you have to take that person to destination. So and you do this progressively, given the capacity that you have left. In a situation like ride sharing, typical metric of that you're trying to optimize for is the total number, the total delay for the passengers you're onboarding. Meaning that for example, if an OpenStreetMap tells you that you could deliver that person in 5 minutes, if you deliver that person in 7 minutes, then it's a 2 minute delay. And your goal is to, of course, optimize the total amount of delays to minimize it and have, satisfied basically client base.
How have you created a data set to use to train these models? Is it all synthetic or simulated data, or is there some set of data that you're using to kind of bootstrap this process?
So initially we started by working with New York City and Manhattan, because there is significant amount of data which is available through the New York Taxi and Limousine Commission. So that makes it interesting to start with. But the way our approach is effectively to use OpenStreetMap to extract as much data as possible to model the environment of the city we're looking at. And OpenStreetMap has also many cities available. Actually, I believe the tool that Uber used when they started their operations. But when it comes to this problem, it's actually possible to train from zero data. So it's very similar in principle to what DeepMind did with AlphaZero. Zero means that there is zero data. What you're setting up is basically a full simulated environment of the city, and you can learn by doing. So the system will initially make random decisions and then progressively realize what is good and what is less good and learn from there. So this is also what is interesting about this problem, and also why a relatively small scale startup like InstaDeep today can tackle those problems, is because not having necessarily a lot of data is not a hurdle, provided you can build a realistic environment. So the data component is really about affecting your ability to build a realistic environment of the city. But if you find a way to do that, technically speaking, you actually do not need data.
You've got this environment beyond the OpenStreetMaps data. What's the kind of shape of this environment? Did you build feel like a custom simulator, or is it just the data, and not a lot of kind of external kind of tooling, or did you use an open source simulation platform that you plug the data into? What does it all look like?
So actually, we built our own simulation engine for this problem, and including visualization. We actually also have visualization teams at InstaDeep. So effectively, OpenStreetMap is used to provide us with metrics about how much time, for example, it takes from going to point A to point B in a city, and basically different in like intermediate points. For example, like a given ride could have like 50 intermediate points or 30 intermediate points, that kind of order of range. But once you have that, effectively everything else runs on our platform. So we've built our own platform to tackle these type of problems. And this is, one of the things that makes it exciting for us. Like, it's something that we have full control on. So we use basically, Kubernetes and TensorFlow, and train on NVIDIA DGX-1, so NVIDIA supercomputers, to be able to extract results and continue to learn. And what is also interesting about this type of solution is that when they are deployed in the real world, you have an ability to keep learning from the results you're getting as well.
You're using DGX-1s. Those aren't cheap. Does your end user need to have the DGX-1 to continue to fine-tune a model? Or is that, what you've got to build up these models and then you can push the models out for inference?
So these are, it's exactly like you said. We basically use those for training, but once a model is trained, it would simply be, about inference, and customer does not necessarily have to have, heavy weaponry as such.
Exactly. So that kind of leads me to the question about generalization and transfer learning, in a sense. For example, if you train a model on, or when you train the model on New York City, can you apply that model to San Francisco? If you do need to then look at San Francisco, do you have to start from scratch, or can you do kind of a traditional transfer learning type of fine tuning? Is there an analogy of that kind of fine tuning and reinforcement learning? How does that all work?
Absolutely. Actually, transfer learning works up to an extent. So you are much better indeed using a train model, even though it's a different city, to get started in another, even though you're going to still require, you know, significant training dependent on how similar the topology of the cities is. You know, if the topology of the city has really nothing to do, then of course that's an issue. If, for example, coming back to Manhattan, if you have another city which has a relatively speaking rectangular shape for its streets and avenues, then obviously, you know, what you have learned in Manhattan would be to a certain extent applicable. So we've seen actually this type of transfer learning happening in different problems. I mean, this is the ride sharing problem. When it comes to, for example, packing bins, it's the same. If you are packing bins in a certain configuration, let's say for 30 items, what you learn can be directly redeployed to larger dimensions, like 200 items and the like, sometimes even without retraining. So, you know, you nailed it on. It's actually, you know, there is the equivalent of transfer learning in these type of problems as well.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when we think about transfer learning applied to computer vision, right, you're often training models on ImageNet, and you're trying to teach the lower layers of the model kind of primitives like textures and edges and things like that. Is that a very problem specific thing, or are there, you know, some equivalent of edges at the, you know, just broad logistics level such that you would get some transfer benefit going, taking a model from bin packing to a ride sharing, for example?
So there wouldn't be lots of intersection between, let's say, taking a bin packing model to ride sharing, but there would be between different bin packing problems or different ride sharing problems. So typically, like to take the bin packing example, for example, like if you're dealing with a problem that has, you know, like multiple hundreds of items, this is actually a large combinatorially exploding problem. However, if you are already having a good performance with a smaller set of, items, actually this set could be as small as 10 items, then indeed the system has figured out something about how do I fit packages together that can be redeployed on larger models. So it's a very interesting topic, but like at InstaDeep, we've been able to take models that have been trained on, let's say, 10 items and deploy them with almost no changes at all to larger sets of problems, like 50 and 100 items, and still getting a type of performance which is better than other OR type algorithms. So indeed, you know, there is transferability, but I would say it's transferability among certain domains. It's things that still have some level of similarity between them.
And within, for example, the domain of bin packing, are there dependencies on kind of the, you clearly mentioned the number of items, but like the shape of the items or the shape of the containers, the bins?
Yes, of course. Yes, of course. If you have, you know, shapes that are quite similar, you would get strong transfer learning features. For example, like if it's the same shape for the general volume, let's say it's a container, and you learn to solve the problem for 10 items, and you're just adding up more items that are relatively similar to the items you already have, in certain cases, you would have very little extra training, meaning that starting with the training model on smaller items would still deliver to you an acceptable performance. And this is actually surprising. When we started working on this with my team, we were not necessarily expecting this type of properties, and yet we got there. And these are some of the results we published in an article at the last NeurIPS, which is called Rank Rewards. We found ways to basically go beyond what had been done for AlphaZero and the game of chess and go to apply this to real concrete problems. And yes, we were surprised that, you know, the level of transfer, transferability from one problem to another was actually pretty high.
What can you say about the data efficiency, or sample efficiency rather, of RL for this particular type of problem? Do you, I don't know what if we want to talk about in terms of time or compute cycles or, runs or batches, but how complex is, getting to a model that, starts to perform well compared to some of the other things that we might apply RL to?
So, there is definitely some complexity, but with, modern equipment, you could get to results in a matter of like something like 24 hours or, a couple of days. We're not talking about like super, super long jobs, but it's not a couple of hours either. So to give you concrete examples, on our NVIDIA DGX-1, we would typically train a model overnight and be satisfied with the results. So it's not something insurmountable, which means that, if you're not Google or if you're not like a very large player, you would not be able to compete. Obviously, it's strongly dependent on the quality of your algorithm. We spend a lot of time, for example, trying to find ways to inject the concept of competitiveness, even though these are like one-player games. You're just trying to solve a problem. One of the secret sauce, for example, in AlphaZero is that you are playing against yourself. And so you're constantly, it's a two-player game where you're constantly challenging yourself. So when you're really bad, like you start with random parameters, it doesn't matter because the other person in front of you, which is, a replica of yourself, is equally bad. What matters is to get slightly better. And it's the same thing when you get to like superhuman performance, you can still improve because what matters in a sense is the relative improvement than the absolute improvement. So we found ways to re-inject this type of principles of, adversarial competitiveness into this problem. And you can get good results, as I said, in, a decent amount of time.
Interesting. Is that part of the work that you published at the recent NURBS?
Yes, absolutely. So we have a paper called Rank Rewards, which was accepted at the DeepRL workshop at the recent NURBS, and it describes exactly the type of results and breakthroughs I'm describing. Yeah.
We talked about how historically these types of OR problems are solved using heuristic methods. One of the trends that I see in deep learning is kind of there's this pendulum where we kind of started at these very model-based approaches to things, and we swung to like pure statistical and learned approaches. And now there's a lot of effort happening to try to fuse model-based and heuristics-based approaches with statistical approaches. Is that something that you've looked at for these types of problems?
Yes, absolutely. The general idea that you're going to inject learnability into a process is a very powerful one. But yes, in some cases, it actually can be pretty efficient to take an existing heuristic, but add learnability into the mix. And it comes to a very natural idea. If you are a large company, for example, you have lots of you have a fleet of trucks, you have lots of packages to deliver tomorrow. And some of these companies would do overnight runs, take the result and use it process their operations for the day. And the next day they're doing the same. It's kind of a waste not to learn anything new. So adding learnability into the mix, and especially constant learnability as you get, more experience through your operations, is a natural idea. So there are two schools. One which is indeed saying you could use existing heuristics and build learning on top, which makes sense. But increasingly, and especially with compute power for machine learning doubling every 3 months and a half or so, and this is a study by OpenAI, in certain cases it becomes possible to learn from first principles, meaning that you do not necessarily need the heuristics. So the honest answer is very problem dependent. Some problems are still too big to be learned completely end-to-end, but some of them can be actually solved using this type of techniques.
So it sounds like your general perspective is that where you can use a pure learning-based solution, that's preferable?
Yes, absolutely, because that removes significant sources of bias. And, you know, by learning through first principles and direct experience, you can get a lot done. There is an additional advantage. As you know, sometimes a heuristics-based model would require specific constraints to be in place and might not tolerate certain number of constraints. When you're taking like a pure learning approach from first principles, you can actually set all the constraints, all the real-world constraints that you care about. And this is also an advantage, means like if these are the real world constraints, and actually there are people in the real world running those operations with those constraints, you know, solutions exist. So as a consequence, a model learning end-to-end could get to that point as well.
You mentioned that one of the considerations is some inherent bias in the heuristics-based models. You know, this might come from constraints or other factors. And that a learning-based approach overcomes those. Have you seen the flip side as well, where the learning, you've seen bias introduced by the learning-based approach that disadvantages it relative to what an organization might want to do?
So, I mean, in general, like if the problem is well formulated and, you know, the system will learn to crack that problem. So, yes, in cases where you see the system not doing what you expect, it really comes down to there might have been some constraints that you forgot to include into the mix. But if you really, you know, give to the system all the constraints that he should care about, you know, the system ultimately will explore and learn to crack that problem with the tools you have. So it's more a question of defining the right set of objectives and what's the space of, you know, possible behavior. If you do this well, there is no reason why a system which has sufficient capacity would introduce significant biases. Just to give you an example, in the game of chess as well, you know, there have been some recent publications. I believe the title of the book is Game Changer, where, you know, chess experts have looked at the behavior of AlphaZero. And, you know, some of them said, you know, this is very interesting because, you know, we believe this is very close to the truth, meaning that the system has explored so many configurations and developed an intuition which is really based on facts that, you know, some people would consider this, you know, including actually Kasparov as, you know, the best manifestation of truth in chess that is possible to achieve.
I'm also wondering about, I imagine when you're talking to enterprises that are considering these types of approaches, there are concerns like explainability and even robustness. You know, when you've got a set of rules, the actions that those rules tell you to take are relatively predictable, whereas with a deep learning solution, I'm imagining, you know, there can be instabilities or your decision boundaries are very complex and you can have the system recommend actions that are, you know, maybe, you know, not actions that you would want to take in the real world. Are these behaviors that you see coming out of systems like these?
I mean, it's a fair point. I mean, explainability will always be, you know, a concern at some level when using deep learning. And even though there is promising research going on in terms of like getting better ways to understand what the system is doing and how it can explain to humans what it is doing, but typically we don't operate into with customers for whom explainability would be extremely strong. So coming back to the examples we discussed, whether it's ride sharing or bin packing, ultimately the customer will care about, you know, in the case of bin packing, how many containers he's using, provided all the constraints about how to pack have been respected. Same thing with ride sharing. You know, the client is going to care about, you know, what's the, you know, average, for example, number of miles driven to deliver one customer and the number of customers delivered. In these cases, it's okay if a few decisions are suboptimal, provided the total, you know, the average decision is better. So in a sense, you're not getting extremely penalized for taking a decision which locally would look suboptimal. So that is typically, you know, the kind of, you know, customers we engage in at InstaDeep for logistics. But I mean, to your point, absolutely. I mean, if you have certain situations for which where that the negative impact of a bad decision can be massive. I don't know, for example, you know, like in, you know, drug manufacturing or things like that. Obviously, explainability could be of interest, but we haven't seen this, you know, with the type of problems we work on, because it's really about logistics and it's about optimizing well-known constraints. And, you know, there's not something which, you know, like if you deliver, for example, a person and it has taken too long for that particular person, you know, that it is a concern. It can be improved, but it's not a massive concern that it would stop all your operation.
True, it wouldn't stop all your operations, but as organizations mature in their use of these types of technologies, they may want to, you know, their perception of what's the right reward function evolves and matures. And at some point, you know, maybe they wouldn't want, you know, a customer to randomly sit in the car and be driven across town only to be driven back because that's what the machine said. Do you have a path to addressing that in this kind of approach, or are they totally antithetical to one another?
You can control this type of like spurious behavior. For example, like typically, like in the example you take, if a car would take someone and really drive around town in crazy ways before delivering that person, you could actually put a very significant constraint on like in a penalty, if you want, on the outcome. So instead of having just, for example, like the total delay that this person experienced, you could say that, you know, beyond a certain point, which is statistically driven and you can collect the statistics for a given city, hey, if you go beyond that, there's really a significant problem. And as a consequence, let's say, you know, the penalty on the reward system would be very high. So that's one of the ways you can actually remove spurious cases from your system.
And when you're engaging with someone around these types of problems, do you find that there is very unique and specific problem definition that needs to happen and kind of building out these reward functions and penalties and things like that? Or, you know, do most people just want a bin packing solution that for which you've already really defined the problem?
So typically when we work with large corporates, those companies have already processes in place, including, you know, and they have a good sense of what type of constraints they are experiencing. So one of the cool things at InstaDeep is that we will adapt to their problem. Our process is pretty general. So we basically put ourselves in the customer's shoes. So we'll take the problem, we'll like look at it the way they look at it. They tell us the constraints they have. And yes, those constraints could change from one customer to another because maybe they're not doing exactly the same type of operations, or maybe because they have different priorities and preferences. So we'll incorporate their constraints and work from there. And as I said, you know, what's pretty cool in the way we look at things and these general systems is that they can actually learn from, you know, the constraints you give them. So you're not a prisoner of given constraints. So yeah. It's not a problem in practice to be looking at different customers and different constraints, because the principles that are behind it, and this is the thing which I'm most excited about, are very general. So no matter how you look, you know, what are your constraints, and some of those could be real physical constraints and others could be preferences. There is always a way to solve your problem, provided that it is actually a real world problem that has solutions, and it's typically the case, and you want to improve your solutions.
And so we spent most of the time talking about reinforcement learning. Are there other approaches that you use for these types of problems, or is that the primary area you're working with?
So, I mean, we also use like, you know, classical algorithms, but these are more for benchmarking. You know, at InstaDeep, we're among the people who believe that, you know, those type of smart systems are there to stay. But when we say reinforcement learning, just to be very clear, and I know the audience is pretty technical, what we believe the most at in InstaDeep is what we believe in the most is the concept of having, you know, a neural net that's going to work with planning type algorithms. For if you look at a technology such as Monte Carlo tree search, it is in the secret sauce of what makes, for example, AlphaZero so good. So I have a great analogy for this. It's this idea, and I presented this at GTC, which is this idea of thinking fast and thinking slow. So this the same title as Daniel Kahneman's book, The Nobel Prize, is this idea that with planning, basically Monte Carlo tree search into this type of algorithms, you're going to be able to think slow, which means you're going to consider many paths and incorporate those paths through planning into your decision. And the thinking fast part is the neural net. So to be very clear, it's not just RL in the sense, hey, I'm experiencing a reward and I'm kind of looking blindly for that reward. I'm actually trying to find, interesting paths. So another way to look at it, which is an analogy I really like, is, in DeepRL, you're like in the dark in a room and you're trying to find the switch. And that is the sparse reward, for example, that you're looking at. But you're like kind of like looking blindly and trying to find the switch. If you add planning MCTS type approaches, it's like you have a searchlight. It's not a perfect searchlight, so it only covers a little bit of area, but at least you're not completely blind, and this will help you be more efficient much faster. So these are the two tech that are used, and it makes a lot of sense. And in a funny way, it's actually interesting that Daniel Kahneman's book, by the way, which is a great book, talks about it from the angle of human neuroscience and human behavioral patterns. But there are some equivalents in the machine learning and AI world.
So let me ask you this: we've spent quite a bit of time talking about this topic and what you presented at GTC. What were the key takeaways that you were hoping to leave your audience there with?
So, for me, the key takeaway is that, machine learning systems are progressively, going to have an impact when it comes to making decisions in the real world. And, while we have mostly seen, those in the context of games, and those games have, started like very simple games, Atari style, and now it's more like StarCraft complex games, I think we are about to see those really spread out and make an impact in the real world. And this is due to, a few key properties of these systems. First, these systems can learn end-to-end. So you can, in certain cases, go from pixels to behavior, or from raw data to behavior, things like that. But these systems get better with scale, and we have reached a point in terms of maturity of hardware and also algorithms that makes deploying these systems at scale a real possibility. So I would to the users, the listeners of the program, I would say that expect a lot of action on these in the real world and not in games anymore. And to a certain extent, if you are having a decision-making system that uses compute and doesn't have learnability deeply embedded in it, that means that probably you will have to change the way you are operating to include AI first approaches and learnability. And that means that lots of industries, and in particular logistics, last mile delivery, are going to be deeply impacted by those.
Awesome. Well, Kareem, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. This is really interesting stuff.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure. And thanks a lot for having me.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. For more information about this and every show, visit TwimmelAI.com. Remember, just 1 week left to register for TwimmelCon AI Platforms, so head over to TwimmelCon.com now. Thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.